As the nuclear crisis in Japan continues, we hear reporters and experts advise that it may be bad, but certainly no Chernobyl. Small comfort. The explosion at the Chernobyl reactor in 1986 spewed radiation that affected broad areas of Europe and poisoned an enormous area on both sides of the border between what's now Ukraine and Belarus. Officially off limits ever since, the Chernobyl exclusion zone was opened to tourists earlier this year. Henry Shookman, a contributor to Outside Magazine, visited and found an eerie wilderness teeming with life. If you have questions about the legacy of Chernobyl, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And Henry Shookman joins us from his home in Santa Fe. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And when you first arrived, was it what you expected?
No, altogether, in every way, it was all very unexpected. First of all, there were no obvious precautions that we were asked to take. You know, we didn't have to wear special suits or carry Geiger counters or anything like that. And then, you know, the first thing that is really so striking is that the towns in the exclusion zone, including Chernobyl itself, have large areas of them have been completely taken over by forest. So, you know, you can be driving down what was a road and there's just sort of a little gap for a vehicle to creep through between the bushes and the birch trees and so on. And so, you know, the whole area was essentially a farmed region until this exclusion zone was set up, whereupon 100,000 people or so were moved out, along with something like 135,000 cows and all the domestic animals and all the species that live around humans, you know, were gone. So this whole area has had a chance, in spite of the radioactivity, to regenerate as a forest.
As a Russian forest, specifically, and you begin your story by describing an encounter with a wild boar.
That's right. There are something like 5,000 wild boar now in the region, you know, which have just come back all by themselves. And there are also bison, European bison. There are roe deer, elk, red deer, and 25 wolf packs. And, you know, it's really kind of the Europe of the Middle Ages.
And indeed, there are a few people farming there and living there as they might have in the Middle Ages.
It's extraordinary, actually. There are something like 91 villages in the zone, and most of them are still either completely abandoned or indeed in some cases buried. They were deliberately bulldozed and buried. You know, the most radioactive ones were just simply buried. But among, you know, there's a handful where a few people who, you know, had lived there for generations. Soon after the creation of the exclusion zone, when of course they were evicted, they came back because they didn't want to live in you know, an apartment building on the edge of Kiev. They would rather have taken the risk of living in their sort of contaminated homeland.
And you join one of these farmers for dinner, and the way you describe it, you go in and you see these unbelievably luscious-looking mulberries, but really, the one thing everybody told you before is don't eat anything that grows there.
I know. Well, of course, that is what I was told. But you know, there are hundreds of people living there who do indeed eat what they grow. They're self-sufficient farmers, and they sort of have no choice. And they, you know, they eat fish from the river. They grow potatoes, you know, barley, oats. And they raise animals and eat their eggs in the case of chickens and so on. So they're completely immersed in the, you know, the sort of nutrient system of that part of the world. And they've just taken the decision that they would prefer to run the risks and live that way. And indeed, actually, so far, the research seems to suggest that they're not significantly worse off, which is surprising on various levels. But the cancer rate among those farmers is only slightly higher than for Ukraine generally. And, you know, it's such a small population that it's not considered statistically significant.
Yeah, and it's interesting, your guide and other people who work there, and yes, things have not changed so much in the former Soviet Union that you're allowed to wander through an area like this without a minder, your guide and all the other people who work in and around the site are, you know, there's that sort of perverse pride. Of course, we're tough enough to withstand a little radiation.
I know. There's sort of nothing that a bottle of vodka won't clean up in the Ukraine, you know. That's sort of the attitude. But I think it's a rather confusing and baffling situation. You know, first of all, yes, there are a few thousand people who come in to work in the region, but they're only allowed to come in 2-week shifts, and they have to have an annual medical. And if there's any sign of ill health that shows up in that could in any way be connected with radiation, they're not allowed to work there anymore. And they receive 3 times normal government pay for working there. So obviously, there's a danger to doing that. The other thing, you know, is that something like 2.7 million people have suffered or are suffering from the Chernobyl fallout. And the worst period was obviously the explosion itself, but then in the months following it, the cleanup operation, which involved 650,000 people, that the Soviets that undertook, you know, many people who worked in that and their descendants are still suffering horribly from it. The population that comes in now to work in Chernobyl, generally speaking, weren't involved in that.
Mm.
So, you know, possibly that explains why they apparently are suffering less, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, we're talking with Henry Shukman about his piece in Outside magazine, Chernobyl, My Primeval Teeming Irradiated Eden. If you'd like to take a look at it, there's a link to it on our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Shannon's on the line calling from Davenport, Iowa.
Hi, I was calling. I was listening to another expert on a lesser radio program yesterday, and she was a pro-nuclear energy individual, but she had put the death toll from Chernobyl at 65, which seemed a little low to me, but I was just wondering if your guest could comment on exactly how they arrive at the numbers in terms of deaths.
Yes. Well, you know, the pro-nuclear lobby puts out all kinds of information, which in a certain way may be correct in that, for example, not that many people actually died directly from exposure to the explosion at Chernobyl. But the cleanup operation that followed went on for 2 years. And over that period, many, many people contracted diseases either then or later. I mean, that's one of the things, of course, with radiation, is that the harm it does doesn't always show up right away, obviously. It may be years later, but traceable back to an exposure to radiation earlier.
So is there any reasonable estimate of those who may have been killed as a result of the explosion, then later radiation?
You know, there's a museum to Chernobyl in Kiev, which puts it at hundreds of thousands. But they are factoring in, you know, all deaths that could conceivably be linked to it.
And there's an element of anti-Sovietism involved in that.
There certainly is, although the Ukrainian government has not been particularly forthcoming either with information about the health effects of Chernobyl, even to this day. The Soviets you wouldn't expect to have been, but nor has the Ukrainian government.
Interesting.
The problem being that if somebody is proven to be suffering or have suffered a health problem from Chernobyl, they're entitled to various benefits. So they have a vested interest in reducing the numbers.
Shannon, thanks very much for the call. Let's go next. This is Roy, and Roy's with us from Binghamton, New York.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I'd like to commend the gentleman for the piece in the Outdoor magazine. I live in a similar area in a kind of a Garden of Eden between the Susquehanna Rivers and the Delaware River, and we're facing not a Chernobyl exactly, but we're facing the onslaught of the natural gas industry and the effect that that's going to have on our virtually pristine aquifers and land. And it's very interesting, the research that the gentleman's done in Russia, seeing that, you know, with the success of the wild boar and how they were able to come back, if we, you know, should these chemicals be allowed to be used in the upstate, that what effect it would have on people that depend on the deer and the fish that we have in quite abundance at the present time.
Well, these are apples and oranges, if you'll excuse the expression. Radiation quite different from the kind of chemical contamination that you're talking about.
But actually, that's not particularly true, because the wastewater from the Marcellus Shale tests particularly high in radioisotopes.
But not in anywhere near the same quantities. So
these quantities are huge, because the wastewater treatment plants in Pennsylvania are already having a very difficult time.
I still don't think it's quite on the same level as Chernobyl.
Let's not
make the comparison quite yet.
No, you're right.
But Henry Shuckman, the evidence of the effect of this radiation on plant life and on the animals there is, well, quite fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, if I could just speak to that. I mean, I think you know, we should bear in mind, I mean, 25 years later, sheep farmers in Wales, there are still some sheep farmers in parts of Wales who cannot sell their lamb because of Chernobyl fallout. The thing with all these, I don't really know about the natural gas, the chemicals used in natural gas extraction and so on, but, you know, these things are not very easily contained, and radiation is the worst at that. Actually, just last summer, thousands of wild boar shot in Germany couldn't be sold for their meat because they were too radioactive, and again, that was from Chernobyl. So, you know, the problem is that it travels very erratically and unpredictably. It travels with the rain, it travels with clouds and wind, and, you know, radioactive particles can be, of course, microscopic, you know, and in their billions. So, and in a case like Chernobyl, where you have this explosion of a nuclear reactor, you've got the fissile materials, you've got the products of the reaction, you've got all the various materials that are exposed to radiation in the course of functioning in the reactor, all of that exploding. So the amount of radioactive debris and waste, not to mention particles, you know, is just sort of uncountable.
We're talking with Henry Shuckman about his piece in Outside Magazine, Visiting Chernobyl 25 Years Later. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And in your piece, you describe some species of trees that have, birch trees, for example, that don't grow as trees in some places, but as bushes, and some animals that have adapted in strange ways and, well, unpredictable ways, really.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, the story that Chernobyl had become this sort of wildlife refuge, I mean, I as far as I'm aware, it started sort of circulating two or three years ago. I know the BBC did a piece on it and so on. In 2008, what has come to light is that actually the idea that it's now this sort of fecund, happy, natural region—I mean, happy for nature, that is, as it were—is not right. That there have been all kinds of genetic anomalies and changes and happening to the various species that live there. For example, there's a high proportion of albino swallows among the swallow population. Just for one example, there are birds with asymmetry in their feathers. In other words, their wings don't look the same. You know, there are, as you say, there are birch trees that have no trunk. So when we look at the large mammal population, which of course in a certain way has a kind of romantic appeal, you know, the wild boar and the elk and bison and so on. it might seem like a wonderful success story for nature that these animals, sort of unknown since the Dark Ages, you know, have come back naturally. Actually, they are the boar, for example, are eating meat from their prey, that much of which is radioactive. What is really happening, I'm sorry, not the boar, the wolves,
yes.
the 200 odd or few hundred wolves that live in the region, you know, what that is doing to their genetic structure is not known yet, but it is known that mice that have been studied in the region are developing new characteristics such as resistance to radioactivity. You know, so some scientists talk about the region as a laboratory of microevolution,
post-apocalyptic laboratory,
something like that, exactly. Where, you know, things are changing at the you know, deep in the DNA, that will have unknown results, presently unknown possibilities. You know, there may be new species already in the making.
Where you can read more about what's happening in the Chernobyl exclusion zone in Henry Schuckman's article in Outside Magazine. Again, there's a link to it at our website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. Henry Schuckman, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow, it's Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Ira Flatow will be here with an update on the deteriorating nuclear power plant in Japan. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.